Good morning to everyone. This is Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link. Welcome to Capital Link's webinar series. We're delighted to have with us today our featured presenter, Kenny Feng, CFA. He is the President and CEO of Allerium. Energy Master Limited Partnerships, MLPs, with a combined market capitalization of more than $400 billion across 100 operating entities, are no longer the sleepy asset class only known and owned by retirees looking for stable cash flows and capital preservation. Institutions are dedicating more resources to understanding and investing in MLPs. Media outlets are covering the sector more frequently and in greater detail. And more public and private energy companies are talking about forming their own MLPs or selling their assets to existing ones. Kenny Feng will discuss what all of these and other macro trends, such as rising interest rates, and what the MLP Parity Act could mean for the full spectrum of investors, from those that are new to the asset class to those who have been following the space since the 1980s. I would like to mention that our event is accessible through a live audio webcast and then will be available as well as an audio archive through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. Please note that the presentation slides that you have on your screen are user-controlled. Now, this means that to access a presentation or any slide, you can click on the button Preview Slide or Next Slide, and you move to that slide on your own. Also, as you can see on your screen, there's a button called Ask a Question, and you're welcome during the presentation to submit a question either through that button, or you can email your question to questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. Again, you can submit a question at any point of time during Kenny's presentation, and he is going to reply to your questions at the end of his slide presentation. I'd like to mention before I turn the floor over to Kenny that the presentations and opinions expressed by the webinar are not intended as a legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and Capital Link bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, this presentation may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. And now I will turn the floor over to Kenny, and I'd like to mention to everyone that we are delighted that we are coming out tomorrow with the second issue of our monthly closed-end fund and ETF newsletter. And you're welcome, if you're not on the list, to register and receive it free of charge. Please visit our website at cef.capitallink.com to request your copy. And Kenny, the floor is yours, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Nicolas, for having us, and thank you to Capital Link as well for organizing this webinar series. As Nicolas mentioned, my name is Kenny Feng, and I am the President and CEO of Allerium, and we'll talk a little bit about what we do in just a moment. If you go to slide 2, you'll see our standard disclosure slide, and since everybody has the PDF available to them, I will not spend any more time than that talking about that. So slide 3, what is Allerium? We are a benchmark and information provider for energy infrastructure companies and MLPs. We really aspire to level the playing field in this asset class and empower investors to make intelligent decisions based off of the different assumptions they make with respect to the markets as a whole, as well as this asset class in particular. Our goal, again, is to be the Wikipedia of this asset class, so to speak, which is the first pass information source as you come across this asset class, whether by way of word of mouth through a friend who's been invested in the space for some time, whether it's through a commercial that you've seen on CNBC or through an ad in Barron's or through an article through the media or attending a conference that you may have been at recently, as more and more companies are going forth in that direction, including Capital Link. We launched the first real-time MLP index on June 1st of 2006, and we've been fortunate since then to work with some great partners who have licensed our indices for the creation of pooled investment vehicles. There's now approximately $14 billion tied to our indices. We're going to talk about two things today. First, really just where MLPs have been historically, and second, where they're going. So first, where they've been historically. If you go to slide 4, this is really one of the reasons you're probably on this webinar, and it's colloquially referred to as the EPD blinking slide or the enterprise blinking slide. And the reason for that is because Enterprise Products Partners, which is one of the larger MLPs, has always put this slide up to demonstrate the performance of the sector as a whole, but more specifically, obviously, their stock in particular has outperformed MLPs as a whole in these particular subcategories. You can see the total return proposition here. Over a 10-year period ending December 31st, 2012, MLPs have meaningfully outperformed other sectors. It doesn't matter what you pick, whether it's small cap, non-U.S. equity, REITs at the S&P 500, Dow Jones Industrial Average, utilities, or commodities. Slide 5 is the other reason that you might be here, which is the income story. As you can see, the yield on the Alerian MLP Index, which again is that benchmark that we mentioned, which was launched on June 1st of 2006, is meaningfully higher than other equity income securities as well as the broader markets as a whole. Slide 6, let me begin by briefly noting what an energy MLP is. The first way to think about this, and really the broadest way to think about this, is that investing in energy MLPs and infrastructure MLPs in particular is an investment over the long term in the build-out of North American energy infrastructure. Again, that's an investment over the long term in the build-out of North American energy infrastructure. The modern iteration of MLPs were legislated into existence in the Tax Reform Act of 1986 and then narrowly defined in the 1987 amendment. And what that basically means is that by confining themselves to the transportation, storage, processing, and production of natural resources and minerals, they are not subject to entity-level taxation. They are, however, subject to the same reporting requirements, including SEC filings like notices of material changes, quarterly reports, and annual reports, as well as Sarbanes-Oxley. Energy infrastructure assets in particular benefit from toll road business models. And what that essentially means is regardless of what the underlying price of the commodity is, they do not take toll to that commodity or take ownership of that particular commodity, meaning that their equation for revenue is just price times volume. There are long-term contracts, barriers to entry, and benign regulation, as well as the development of North American resources, has led to distribution growth over the past decade of roughly 7%. The statistics you see on the bottom regarding 25 years of growth, we'll talk about a little bit further on slide 7. Today, there are 99 MLPs, which include 9 variable payers and 6 general partners, as well as 6 special units, which make up a total of $412 billion of market capitalization. That's roughly comparable to where REITs are today, and a little bit smaller than ExxonMobil by itself. If you look at this chart of the history of IPOs, you can notice 2 specific things. First is that there have been a lot of IPOs in the past 2.5 years or 30 months, 35 in fact, and there's a lot of purple. Purple is an other category, and there's 14 of those names, or 40% of the IPOs that we've seen. These include assets such as fertilizer, refining, frac sand, coking, compression, rigs, and fuel distribution. The reason we want to make special mention of that is that IRS private letter rulings, or PLRs, have broadened the scope of MLP qualifying income over recent years. As the asset class has grown, issuers and bankers have discovered that the investor market for MLPs is actually fairly heterogeneous, and investors have different investment objectives, different risk tolerances, which has allowed to the greater proliferation of other subsectors. In addition, there are 10 MLPs in registration today, 2 of which are in the coal business, 3 are gathering and processing, 2 are wholesale distributors, 2 are petroleum transportation companies, and 1 is a petrochemical company. There are also 24 non-energy MLPs, which represent about $56 billion in market capitalization, which includes the likes of Blackstone and Icahn Enterprises. On slide 8, you can see that keeping pace with the growth of the number of MLPs and the operating entities themselves is the number of pooled investment vehicles. Beginning in 2004, with the passage of the American Jobs Creation Act, we started to see closed-end fund structured as C-Corps from a tax perspective. You also saw the first RIC-compliant closed-end fund in 2005, the first ETN in 2007, the first C-Corp open-ended fund, C-Corp closed-end fund, and RIC open-ended fund in 2010, and the first RIC ETF in 2012. There is now $45.8 billion across 62 vehicles. C-Corp closed-end funds are the greatest in number and market share, with 18 representing $16.5 billion. After that, you see C-Corp open-ended funds and ETNs at about another $8 billion each. C-Corp ETFs, there's five of those, make up about $7 billion, and the balance is in RIC-compliant funds. So that includes, again, closed-end funds, open-ended mutual funds, and ETFs. If you look at the next three slides, slides 9, 10, and 11, it basically just depicts a graph of exchange-traded product growth, closed-end fund growth, and open-ended mutual fund growth since these products have been in existence. Again, that's since 2007, 2004, and 2010. Slide 12 basically depicts that funds have taken market share from individual investors, as we mentioned earlier, with the launch of these different products. But part of the story is also from institutions. The individual investor made up about 90% of the investment market 10 years ago, and they were largely a homogenous group, retirees who were looking for steady income and were not looking for a significant amount of capital appreciation or looking to take on very much business risk. But in recent years, as the asset class has proliferated, we've also seen increased participation from pensions, foundations, and endowments. And you can see on slide 12 that the institutions that are increasingly allocating to MLPs include different retirement systems across the board from all the different parts of the country. Traditionally, these organizations, pensions, endowments, and foundations, have shied away from the asset class due to the back office burden that is brought on from investing in directly in MLPs. But obviously, it's hard to stay away from the total return and yield propositions of the asset class that we've talked about previously. On slide 13, you can see that foreign investment has also grown in a meaningful way in the asset class over the past 7 years. And this is a chart that comes from PricewaterhouseCoopers, which does the majority of the work from a processing standpoint of K-1s. Foreign investment has largely grown through total return swaps, as well as Delta 1 notes, which do not generate those K-1s, which would otherwise inhibit investment. Slide 14, you see the cover of Barron's from about a year ago, and what this really depicts is that MLPs were largely a word-of-mouth story for years, again, among retirees that were looking for steady income. When you walk into a room at a conference talking about MLPs, about 25% of advisors were intimately familiar with the story, and this is about 5 years ago, and had been invested on behalf of clients for years, and maybe as early as the late 80s. The other 75%, however, had largely never heard of it or didn't think it was worth the hassle of dealing with K-1s or were burned by the drilling partnerships of the early 1980s. But now the asset class is covered by banks with the smallest sell-side research departments and by national media's organizations that run front-page stories, as I mentioned with this cover of Barron's. You also have webinars like the one that we're on today, which further extend the story and have increased capital flow. So now that investors are familiar with the history, we'll talk a little bit about where this asset class is going and whether or not it has legs. First, slide 15, we'll touch upon interest rates, legislative risk, and a few current trends. So first, interest rates. What this chart really depicts is the MLP yield, 10-year Treasury yield, Fed funds rate, and target over the past 10 years. With the Federal Reserve indicating that the Federal Open Market Committee may taper purchases of the Treasury securities as well as agency backed securities, you've seen a move in the 10-year Treasury yield up 96 basis points to 2.59% over 8 weeks in May and June. Specifically, you can see that move at the right of the chart, as this chart depicts a 10-year history. MLPs during this particular time period were up 1.1% on a total return basis, but did experience drawdowns of about 7.2% and 4.7% within that 8-week span. To understand why there were V-shaped recoveries on each drawdown, we really look at history. Specifically, during June 2004 to 2006, where you see that ladder function, the Fed funds rate rose 25 basis points every 6 weeks. For the month following the announcement, which initially happened on April 21st of 2004, MLPs dropped 4.1%, and the correlation to the 10-year Treasury was about 0.92, obviously very high. But a month later, correlations were again insignificant, and MLPs had recovered to previous levels. during the Fed funds move from 1% to 5.25% during that time period, MLPs actually returned 38.7% on a total return basis. And really what that tells you is that distribution growth, among other factors, carried the day. As equity income, MLPs typically will respond unfavorably to sudden announcements of increases. And that's something you're going to see also in utilities, REITs, and anything else that has an income orientation to it. But due to generally conservative financing, built-in inflation hedges, and really the energy renaissance story, which many of you are familiar with, that is what's going to mitigate the offsetting decrease from yield exposure. On slide 16, we talk about another question that many people have asked us, which is, what is going to happen to this asset class from a legislative perspective, and how do congressional leaders look at the asset class? Is there a risk that MLPs will go the way of Canadian income trusts on Halloween of 2006? And what we tell you as we have that conversation is that that already happened in 1987. There was a narrowing of the qualifying income definition, which prevented further abuse of the structure as tax shelters. And so what you've got instead is businesses that, for the most part, are going to have stable and growing cash flows. The Nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation has an annual estimate that they put out of foregone revenue as a result of different expenditures that the government undertakes. As it specifically relates to MLPs, we're looking at about a $7.5 billion number over the course of the next 5 years, or $1.5 billion per year. If you take that, that's barely 0.1% of the federal budget deficit today. So we would call that a drop in the bucket. Another reason we have confidence that MLPs will not be targeted specifically from a legislative standpoint is that you see increasing talk in the government about energy independence. Whether or not you believe in the story of energy independence and whether it's going to happen in the next decade or whether it's going to happen further out than that, to us is not especially relevant. And the reason is because it's become a political talking point. So it seemed counterintuitive to go after the particular asset structure that is going to encourage the development of that energy independence. Third is the MLP Parity Act, and that's something that, again, some of you may have heard of beforehand, and what it really seeks to do from a sponsor's perspective is to level the playing field between traditional fossil fuel producers with different forms of renewable energy, including wind and solar. It was first proposed during the 112th Congress under House Bill 6437 and Senate Bill 3275. Today, that is now House Bill 1696 and Senate Bill 795 under the 113th Congress. Those two bills have 18 co-sponsors and 3 co-sponsors, respectively. Now, what we would say is, you know, many people have asked us whether or not we believe the MLP Parity Act is actually going to pass, and I would tell you in its current existence and in its current time frame, it's probably unlikely. But the reason it's important is it gives you a perspective that instead of attacking the structure and attacking the existing support that legislation has for the fossil fuel transportation industry, what you're actually seeing is a desire to add on to that particular legislative construct through renewable fuels. And so it gives us a little bit of perspective and a little bit of confidence as it relates to how Congress is thinking about this asset class. Another reason for that really is because conceptually, I think you have energy infrastructure companies which are now thought of as toll roads, airports, schools, and hospitals, like the infrastructure of the nation as a whole. And the reason really for that is because of the education outreach of the NAPTP, the National Association of Publicly Traded Partnerships. Next, you see on slide 17, 18, and 19, we're going to talk a little bit about some current trends that are happening in the MLP space today. The first is crude by rail. And really what that story is that as the development of shale gas and oil has continued to proliferate in this country over the past 5 to 10 years, infrastructure has not quite kept up from a pipeline construction standpoint. The reason for that, obviously, is because MLPs exercise a fair degree of capital discipline when it comes to the construction of new assets. They are not going to build on spec, and what that really means is they need to get a certain amount of commitment from shippers before they're going to undertake a construction project. And because of that, you're going to see a lag between when assets come online from a producer standpoint to when you actually have the infrastructure takeaway capacity to move it from supply centers to demand centers. So rail offers producers increased speed to market versus a new build pipeline, and they have historically been thought of as a bridge gap, to bridges the gap between when that first production comes on to when you actually see pipelines being built. But for a variety of reasons, including connectivity, including legislative, including regulatory hurdles, rail is actually being seen as a more viable medium and long-term solution now, something that could support and be supplemental to the construction of pipelines and may exist into the future. They also provide greater flexibility with short-term contracts. The map that we've depicted below specifically talks about the Bakken shale play and the transportation options for the Bakken to go to both the east and the west coast for further refining. So far, you've seen MLPs invest about $2 billion in crude rail terminals. They've also been engaged in various loading facilities. And what I think we're going to see over the medium term in particular is more and more MLPs participate in that particular story. On slide 18, we see the repurposing of pipelines to address various bottlenecks. Cushing in particular has been a story that's been noted meaningfully over the past couple of years as being a place of bottleneck where a lot of crude oil has arrived at Cushing and has been stranded there due to the absence of takeaway capacity. But as you can see from proposed projects as well as Seaway, which has already been reversed, there is going to be the opportunity to take some of the assets that are sitting either idle or underutilized and to repurpose those to debottleneck what's happening at Cushing as well as other areas. We believe this is an important part of the story because there are going to be assets that are really lent to be not so much redundant, but can be repurposed. And it speaks to really the longevity of the MLP story. It also speaks to the fact that when you have investment in larger cap securities, there is a reason why those names are afforded a particular premium. And the reason is because when you look at a larger asset map and you've got both geographic and business diversity, when you take a pipeline that may be underutilized offline to repurpose it, that impact your cash flow can probably better be mitigated when you've got revenue being produced across different regions as opposed to being more specifically focused in one place. On slide 19, you see that feedstock demand has also driven NGL infrastructure growth. And these are a list of various pipelines where you've seen that project go through. Many of you are probably familiar with the gas shale story in particular, where over the past 10 years, a technique that really began or was developed further out of the Barnett has become a meaningful part of the story in different parts of the United States. And as that gas supply has come online, as that NGL feedstock has come online, due to the rich gas that comes associated with the natural gas that comes out of the ground, there is the opportunity for these producers of petrochemicals to really have a lower cost feedstock. And you've heard a lot of these chemical companies talk about building facilities that have not been built in 30 years. You've also got just greater interest across the board as a result in the infrastructure development to move those particular assets around. And so this is just a list of some of the projects that we do believe are coming online for that particular reason. So the growth side of the story is really driven by, again, the development or the ability of MLPs to develop additional assets to support the renaissance that we've seen on the energy side in domestic production, as well as acquisitions. And that's not a slide that we put in here. But on the acquisition side, there's still about $200 billion or so of assets that are sitting at C corporations, which are midstream assets, and in particular at the integrated oil majors. What we've noted over the past 10 years is that there isn't a particular time frame or a long-term time frame by which these integrated majors are going to push these assets into the MLPs, but we do believe that it will slowly happen over time. And the reason we believe that is because the shareholders of these particular corporations are not paying management to go and operate these midstream assets, which they really largely view as cost centers. They're paying them to go and take exploratory risk, to go and find these high-risk, high-reward opportunities, and to find the next big oil play or the next big gas play. And so they've got an incentive to sell these assets down to the midstream companies and redeploy that capital into a drilling budget. Now, obviously, the midstream companies are incentivized to operate these assets more efficiently because it's the only thing that they do, and it's what they spend the vast majority of their time doing. So the growth story all combined gets you to slide 20, which is what we call the simple math slide. You basically take a roughly 6% yield today, 4-5 distribution growth over the long term, and it would lead to 10-11% on a total return basis annualized. Again, that's not something that we expect to happen year in and year out, but it's something that we would expect to happen over the long term, 10-11% annualized, which we think compares very favorably to many other asset classes. Finally, I want to spend some time on slide 21, which is what we call different strokes for different folks. And we apologize if the slide is a little bit small. We tried to cram a lot of information in there. But really what it discusses is a research project that we're undertaking at this time, which is to help investors better understand what is going to be the most suitable manner for them to access the MLP asset class. Some of you may have been invested through direct investment, others are through closed-end funds, others are through open-ended mutual funds, and still others are through exchange-traded products like ETFs and ETNs. Now, obviously, Capital Link, with the annual conference that they put on in April in New York City, focused specifically on closed-end funds and ETFs, and that's how our relationship with them began. But these are the different ways by which you can invest in the MLP sector. Again, as I mentioned beforehand, 10 years ago, the investor market was deemed to be very homogenous. It was a retiree group that was comfortable with Schedule K-1s because they were looking for stable and steady income, not looking for a tremendous amount of growth, but just looking for a way to get tax-deferred return of capital, as well as an effective means of wealth transfer because of the step-up in basis. But over the past 10 years, as the asset class has proliferated, as these different pooled investment vehicles have come online, we've actually seen that the investor market is far more heterogeneous than previously deemed to be the case. And the reason this is significant is because if you look at the second to last column as well as the second to last row as well as the last row, you see the total number of products that are out there as well as the AUM. If you stack up all the 62 funds that I mentioned earlier, in the top 10, every single one of these types of funds is represented. And what that really speaks to is the fact that investors look at this asset class differently. Their response to a handful of different questions is going to govern what they think is going to be the most appropriate investment product for them. These include questions such as, how do I feel about leverage, for example? If you're not comfortable with leverage, you may shy away, obviously, from some of the types of funds that are going to utilize that. And that could be for a variety of different reasons in terms of how you feel about leverage. How do you feel about credit risk? For some people, they had a very bad experience with what happened in 2008 with auction rate preferreds and with exchange-traded notes and exposure to the financial organizations, and they don't want to touch that again. That's going to govern how you think about that in particular. What are you looking for from a capital market assumption standpoint? Do you think of this asset class specifically for after-tax yield? Do you think of this asset class as being in the third or fourth inning of a long-term total return story that's going to continue to return 16.5% annualized over the next several years? That's going to govern whether or not you're looking for an ETF, an ETN, an open-ended mutual fund, or a closed-end fund, and whether you're looking for a RIC-compliant fund or a C-Corp taxed fund. So it's important to think about these particular different questions as you're looking at the different strokes for different folks, and we want to make sure that investors understand there is no one best investment product for every particular investor. And that includes coming from an organization like us where we do have licensees who obviously launch very specific types of products. There is no one best product or means to invest in MLPs. We do want to say that if you are a U.S. taxable investor, you don't mind filing K-1s or, say, tax filings, or don't mind giving them to your accountant to handle, and you're comfortable building your own portfolio or taking on single security risk, you will always be better off directly investing in MLPs. And let me say that again. U.S. taxable investor, don't mind state tax filings or K-1s, and are comfortable building your own portfolio or taking single security risk, you will always be better off investing directly in MLPs. And that's just because of the tax efficiency of them due to the tax-deferred return of capital mechanism, where 70 to 100%, generally speaking, of distributions are considered tax-deferred return of capital. And so taxes paid later as opposed to today are obviously better. And so because of that, those particular characteristics are going to govern your investment there. But not everybody fits into every single one of those buckets, and that's why you've seen the proliferation of these different funds today. And so that wraps up what my prepared remarks are at this particular time. And what we're going to do now is take a look at some of the questions that have been queued up and spend a little bit of time thinking about those. So let's just take a moment right now to talk about that. So first is a question that we've had, and this is something that many of you have talked about, or rather probably have seen in the public markets, which is the battle over Lin. And let me just, for those who are not as familiar with the Lin story, let me just talk about that briefly. Let me also say, just from a legal and tax standpoint, that this is not going to be considered and should not be considered to be any form of professional advice in terms of what you should do from an investment perspective. Lin Energy is the largest E&P MLP out there, E&P being exploration and production. There's about 10 E&P MLPs that are currently in existence. Lin was the first one to go public under the modern iteration in 2006, so it's been about 7 years. The market cap of the company historically has been in the high single digits of billions of dollars, and so they were meaningfully higher than the other E&P MLPs that have been out there. Beginning in earlier this year, Lin came under fire from Barron's, or at least was first specifically addressed in Barron's, but was first published through independent research, third-party research, that suggested that Lin's manner of accounting for its hedges was very aggressive. And as a result of that, the maintenance capex, so to speak, was not properly accounted for, resulting in a unit price that should actually be meaningfully lower than where it was trading at. Over the past couple of weeks, that story has become a lot more interesting to many investors because Lin has voluntarily disclosed that the SEC is undertaking an inquiry into whether or not this is in fact true. Barron's has covered the story through a series of different articles, which obviously you can find online over the past 4 months or so. And so what does that all mean? It means that the stock price sunk from $39 down to about $20 and has obviously traded back up since then. For those of you who follow the stock, the ticker is LINE, and the associated C-Corp is LINCO, LNCO. It's taxed as effectively as a C-Corp, but it is structured as an LLC. What does this story mean, and what do we think of these accounting practices? We would tell you that we can't particularly comment, unfortunately, on these specific undertakings that Lin is engaging in. I would say that a lot of the stories that you've seen from a Barron's perspective, it is important to also consider the perspective of sell-side research, which has been covering the space for some time. So you basically have two camps that have been set up, Barron's and the independent research together on one hand are taking the perspective that the accounting practices are fairly aggressive, that Lin's unit prices are really worth somewhere between $8 and $17. Then you have the sell-side research analysts on the other hand, which have been continuing to argue that their method of accounting, when you actually look at it, and Lin has also disclosed this through 8Ks as well as through various presentations, is not as aggressive as is being described and is a practice that is consistent with the rest of industry. We would encourage investors really to think of it this way. Energy infrastructure MLPs are very different than E&P MLPs. The reason infrastructure MLPs are different, the reason that a lot of people like them, is because they are hard assets, and people hold on to them as having hard asset value the same way that people like REITs for that reason, which means that they have a static asset base, which may be growing and obviously requires maintenance, but it is static. E&P MLPs are a little bit of a different animal, and the reason is because they do have a declining asset base, which means if you think about the asset class as a whole, it's probably worth reflecting on the fact that you do need to replace those reserves in order for you to really continue to grow or to continue to maintain the production level that you've had in the past. And that's going to be a little bit different than obviously than a pipeline or a storage tank. That said, like any other opportunity, every security does have a price. And so we would encourage investors to think about it that particular way. There's a higher business risk obviously associated with E&P MLPs. You can hedge out production. You've seen Lin as a company, for example, do that on the natural gas side. You can also hedge out oil production obviously as well. it's a little bit trickier to hedge out NGLs because the derivatives market is not as well developed on that particular side. But again, we do encourage investors to think about the fact that this asset class has grown and has continued to proliferate because of the broadening out of the definition, as well as the fact that you've seen more companies undertake this structure under the existing definition. So what we would tell you as it relates to their particular practices is to really do the research and to better understand how you particularly think about maintenance capex and how you think about what is necessary for Lynn or any other company with a declining asset base to sustain its production and what the costs are associated with that on the financial side. And whether or not you want to undertake that, obviously, is going to be a decision based off of your particular assumptions from an investment standpoint, as well as your risk tolerance level. Second, there is a question that we've seen as, what is the IPO trend? What particular MLP classes are likely to have more IPO activity? And also, do we see a rising trend in foreign-operated MLPs going forward? As it relates to that, I think the current IPO trend, I would tell you, we've got 10 MLPs that are currently in registration. As I mentioned, those are across the board. They're literally everywhere, and I think that's going to continue to be the case. We had a record number of private letter rulings that took place last year, and I think it's an interesting part of the story because more and more assets that are supporting existing activities, so we mentioned beforehand, transportation, storage, gathering and processing, and production of natural resources and minerals, activities that are specifically supporting that part of the supply chain, which mean if you can't make it happen, if you can't make it happen without this particular process, then it's going to be considered qualifying income. And that's at least a general rule that's been part of the story over the past couple of years. That doesn't include everything, but it's a kind of general rule of thumb for how the IRS has been thinking about it. So we do think you're going to continue to see the proliferation of different IPOs. As I mentioned beforehand, over the past couple of years, that's included things like nitrogen fertilizer coming back in a meaningful way. That means refining, and that means coking, among other things. And so as these different assets are thought to, again, encourage domestic energy infrastructure investment, they have been put into the MLP structure as well. One of the things in particular, just to speak a little bit more on that, is the variable distribution MLP. Again, a couple of years ago, you started to see these securities come back, and now there's 9 of them. And they're going to be most suitable for the types of assets that are much more cyclical, and that includes things like refining. For those of you who follow the refining space, know that is notoriously volatile and notoriously cyclical, and that's what's happened really over the past couple of years. The variable distribution payers, those variable refiners, have been hit over the past month to 2 months, and that's been driven by a variety of different factors, including weak gasoline demand, as well as the fact that you've seen the spread between WTI and Brent narrowed to close to $5. And so you're going to see more cyclicality, and what the companies that have gone public have said is, we're not going to pay a stable distribution because we know we can't, and that's just a function of our business. But we do believe that there are investors who believe in the story itself, who believe that we have a well-positioned asset, and who want to invest in the company specifically for that reason. And so, again, as a testament to the fact that the market is far more heterogeneous than was previously deemed to be the case, these variable payers have been able to go public, have been able to find an investor base. They tend to be more institutional than retail, which again speaks to the investment objectives of some of those institutional investors who believe in the secular story. But again, we are seeing the proliferation of companies like that, and I think that's going to continue. Some of the companies that had talked about IPOing their assets back in 2007 before the financial crisis are now revisiting that conversation again. A company like Devon, for example, pushed by activist shareholders, are talking about creating their own MLP. So I do think we're going to continue to see companies on the E&P side either IPO their logistics assets or take their E&P assets that are in a slow decline phase and put them into the MLP structure again because they can redeploy that capital into their drilling budget into areas that are returning higher returns. We also expect that you'll see refiners, and that's already happened to a large extent with companies like Delek, for example, which have taken their logistics assets public. Marathon has done a similar thing, and we continue to expect the different refiners to be pushed to do something similar by their shareholders as well. And with that, we also believe, again, that the other category that you saw on the chart of MLP IPOs will continue to proliferate, and you're going to see more and more of these different types of companies go public in different asset classes. So as these different businesses come through, what we want to do is encourage investors to understand that there are different business risks. Not all MLPs are the same. They all have very different business models and are going to be exposed to different things. And so we do want to encourage investors to really understand what they're owning before they jump in. Finally, we'll just talk about whether or not the K-1 structure may change and not be required. That's another question that we've gotten through this webinar. And I would tell you, there was a push for that some time ago. There was the idea that MLPs, you may have heard this, that MLPs are on a similar trajectory to the way that REITs were 20 years ago. And in a funny way, you've actually seen the market cap catch up. They're close to about $400 billion now. There aren't as many MLPs as there are REITs in terms of numbers, but the market cap is largely caught up at this point. And what that really speaks to, I think, again, is there isn't as significant a push from the organization, from the trade organization, or from the MLPs themselves to move the K-1 structure into 1099s. That hasn't been our understanding in terms of the conversations we've had. There hasn't been a deliberate effort to get that through Congress. I don't even know if you could get something like that through Congress at this particular time. Just given all that's been going on politically as well as from a regulatory standpoint. So we do not see the K-1 structure as far as the MLPs and what they're currently under adapting to that new model. So I would tell you that we're likely to continue to see K-1s, and unfortunately that continues to be a little bit of a tax headache for you or your accountant. But we will say that over the past couple of years, different financial services software, and this is speaking more to the individual investor, like TurboTax is actually very adept at handling a K-1 for the most part. So with that, I will turn it back over to Nicholas, and I want to thank you and just thank Nicholas as well as CapitalLink for their time today.
Well, Kenny, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting, very insightful presentation, and it's a hot topic. MLPs are clearly attracting a lot more attention, and I think especially in the current environment. So thank you very much for a great and very timely presentation. I'd like to remind everybody that this presentation will be archived at www.capitallinkwebinars.com, and you can access it on demand anytime you would like. Kenny, thank you very much, and we look forward to another webinar with you in the near future.
Thank you.
We can all disconnect. Thank you. Bye-bye.